start the pre-record now, and then we can always stop it wherever we want, and then we can have that edited. Not a problem at all. All right.
That's fine.
All right. Bruce, are you ready?
Yeah, ready.
This is after 10:30 news, right? Okay, perfect. I just have to get my senses about me, you know? There we go. Right. And a very good morning to you. This is Today Keto with you. As you know, if you tune in regularly all the way through until midday, but if it's the first time that you've tuned in, let me welcome you to the show. Thank you for allowing us into your space. We talk about all sorts of interesting things. We do talk about the politics. We talk about lifestyle and a whole range of other issues that impact on you directly. Now, one of the issues that I've been quite passionate about is what's happening in our oceans. You know, we call this place that you and I live in, we call it Earth, but ironically, 70% of this planet is actually covered by water. It's an essential resource for the water that we drink, the air that we breathe, and generally sustaining life on this planet. So, why am I so interested in it? Well, we've been talking about this over years. Year in and year out, we've been testing the limits of this particular resource. Commercial overfishing, poaching, it's certainly impacted on the traditional fishing communities as well. If one just thinks about South Africa and the Western Cape, and I'll get into that, a lot of people have been turned to poaching. But there's one thing I want to mention before we do that. According to the World Economic Forum, fish accounts for about 17% of all animal protein consumed in the world. 26% of that consumed in the poorest and least developed countries. Now, the ocean is also a very important resource when it comes to nearly 60 million people working in fisheries and aquaculture. And I think there's around 200 million jobs that are directly and indirectly connected with the fishing sector. Going back to the poaching, you've had all this commercial overfishing. You've had communities in the Western Cape, for example, that were forced to turn to poaching. They were then aided by crime syndicates, organized crime, things like Paddler Moon, certainly dangerously low as well. But then we're not alone. Somalia, as a result of overfishing, we know the story. A lot of those local communities turned to piracy. And one of the hardest hit fish is the Pacific bluefin tuna. Now, according to the media, and that's why I've got a professional to talk to us about this, according to the stock assessment levels, it shows that the population sits at around 3.3% of its unfished level. Now, on this point of the Pacific bluefin tuna, and bluefin tuna in general, a UCT scientist was recently awarded a medal by the Emperor of Japan for the amazing work that he's been doing to try and save the bluefin tuna. It was awarded through the embassy in Cape Town. So you are joined by Emeritus Professor of Applied Mathematics at UCT. A very good morning to you, Doug Butterworth.
Good morning.
So let's start with those numbers. You know, I work in the media, and I sometimes get really skeptical about some of the numbers in the media. So maybe we should start there. If we talk about fishing in general and then the numbers related to the bluefin tuna, what can you tell us about that?
Well, to talk generally and internationally at the moment, the situation is perhaps better now than one would have said 20 years ago. Essentially, the latter half of last century saw many of our fish populations reduced to low levels, but particularly in the developed world over the last 20 years, with sound management practices being brought into play, many of those resources are not fully recovered, but well on the road to a better status.
Okay, well, that's a bit of good news, and we always like a bit of good news. Some work to be done, I would imagine, and we'll get into that. So how does an applied mathematician end up doing work on, you know, fish population studies?
That's always the key question, and the simple answer is that the answer is a number. I originally came from physics, and it turned out quite accidentally to be an excellent background, because when I started in this field 40 years ago, it was just starting to realize the importance of quantitative analyses, and one borrows from the ideas and training in physics to apply them in fisheries.
So the one thing that's always, I think both my producer and myself, Bruce, were talking about this earlier. I mean, how exactly do you keep track of fish numbers when they spread so widely and mainly out of sight?
The simple answer is with difficulty, but one needs to particularly distinguish the problems with fish where you don't see them, at least with some marine species like whales and seals. They come to the surface or even onto land, so you can count them somewhat more easily. It's not never straightforward. But with fish, essentially, it's all indirect. If you're lucky, if it's a species that comes close to the surface, you can use aerial surveys. The main method we use is called catch rate. In other words, if there are more fish around, they'll be easier to catch, and we use that. But the other methods that are used, particularly in South Africa for some of our species, are acoustics, in sonifying the fish, and you work out from the strength of the echoes you get back how many are there. And then perhaps the most exciting new development is what I'd call genetic fingerprinting, as the public would understand it. Essentially, by taking the genetic fingerprints of fish, one can link adults and offspring, and from that information, work out how many there are.
Okay, now I want to get into the work that you've been credited for. You've been credited for essentially keeping certain fish species out of the danger zone. And I'm quite sure you've been supported by a lot of great people as well. Now, how did your work translate into action? Let's talk about the work you were doing and then how that translated into action specifically.
Yes. The first thing is to acknowledge that this is a team game. It's never one person alone.
Absolutely.
And one must acknowledge the contributions of others, and we build on each other and we help each other and we also argue with each other. but essentially the approach that I've been mainly associated with it is explained as simply as saying, set the rules before you play the game. One of the great difficulties in fisheries is when things get bad, the tendency is to say, well, let's wait another year and hopefully they're better. And in fact, what turns out is 50-50, they're worse. And that was the problem of last century and the essential approach we've been promoting and has turned out very successfully in some cases, though one must be careful here. Sometimes it's as much good luck as good management.
Sure.
But our approach has been to come up with pre-agreed formulae, get everyone buying into it, and then stick to those formulae. Because if things get better, you can have more. But also, if things get worse, you've got to be prepared to take less.
Okay, you talk about formulae. I'm going to ask you to take me into your confidence. what exactly are you talking about? Can you give me an example of the type of formulae that you are suggesting people use?
Right, I'll take you a very simple one and a difficult one at the moment because our local sardine population is not in a good state at the moment.
Yeah.
And is that our fault or is it natural fluctuation? I'll leave you to decide that later. But essentially, the formula we have in simple terms, and forget the bells and whistles for the moment, is at the end of each year, the fisheries department goes out with its vessel, does an acoustic survey of the population, comes back with an estimate of the abundance, and the next year's catch of directed sardine, or sometimes known as pilchard, is set at a number, a formula, which happens to be very simple, just a little more than 9% of whatever number we come back with. Now, that sounds very simple, and it's deliberately simple in the sense that your stakeholders, your industry and others, understand simple things better than complicated things. But there's a myriad of calculations that goes on underneath that to come up with the magic number, which in this case is just over 9%.
Okay. Now, do you see a role, and I'm a big fan of artificial intelligence, right? Sensors and then using algorithms to teach computers how to, you know, obviously do what they need to do. Do you see a role for artificial intelligence? Is there a role already played by artificial intelligence when it comes to looking at fish stocks, numbers, and potential predictions?
There is some work along those lines. It's not an area I'm familiar with.
Sure.
And there are some of the algorithms that are used in the various methods that are applied to try to get abundance estimation of fish populations, which use those sort of ideas. But most of the work we are doing is more basic than that. The problem is one's got to always be aware that this is an inexact science.
Correct.
And when I say we come up with an estimate, and I stress the word estimate, of how many fish are out there, the typical error we've got with any estimate is 20% if we're lucky,
oh, wow.
Sometimes bigger than that. So the art in this game is dealing with uncertainty. One has to, and it's surprising actually how well one can do when we check this out by computer simulations, but one has to be aware of the fact that the information that is coming in is subject to quite substantial error, and then have formulae that take those errors into account.
Well, I'd rather on the side of caution. I'd rather say, hey, man, we've got stock levels sitting at, you know, 5%. We need to do something at it. And yes, as opposed to saying, oh, well, you know, 20% on the other side, maybe we're not in as much trouble as we think. So that's why we need people like you. But let's talk a little bit about the award from the Emperor of Japan.
Yes, that really was primarily in recognition of the work I've just been talking about developing these formulae for setting quotas or total allowable catches, as they're sometimes called. And it was very much also within the spirit of what you've just mentioned about being careful, because in technical terms, that's what's known as the precautionary principle. But equally well, one's got to find an appropriate balance, because the only really safe way to cross the road is never to cross it, if you get my meaning. So there's got to be a bit of common sense used here. The reason for the linkage with Japan is, though my work is to a large extent local in South Africa, it's also quite widely spread across the globe, and I've had intensive linkages with Japan, particularly on tuna work, where I've been on their delegations to tuna commissions for over 20 years. I've also been involved in some international court cases on their delegations to those, and it was in recognition of that that they gave the award, which was in part for work with the Japanese themselves, but also in recognition of my worldwide contribution.
Now, there's also this, and congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
It's, you know, we need all the positive news we can in the country at the moment, and we pounced on this when we saw the good work yourself and, you know, you and your team were doing. But there's also a conference currently taking place at the moment right here in Cape Town, specifically dealing with the southern bluefin tuna. What's it all about?
Right. This relates to the way scientific work and other inputs, because it's not only science that is pertinent in managing fisheries, the socioeconomic aspects as well, but it's how the scientific work and other work is turned into practical decision making. Always with scientists, there will be some scientific grouping at which one's analyses are presented and are argued out and lead to a scientific recommendation of, say, what the catch limit should be. But that has to be taken up to a decision-making body. If one's talking about local fisheries, it would be ultimately through the department responsible to the minister who makes the final decision. When we go internationally, though, it becomes a little more difficult, because at least in one country, there's one boss, shall I say, the minister, who makes the decision. When you go international, it becomes difficult. And one's talking with tuna, particularly. Tuna is outside primarily the 200-mile zones of individual countries. It's oceanic, it's international high seas. And what is set up is what are called regional fishery management organizations for different species. Southern bluefin tuna stretches right from the east of New Zealand across virtually to the coast of South America, the Atlantic coast of South America. So there are a number of nations involved in the fishery, but to any large extent, there are only, I think it is eight of them, that are members of what is called the Commission for the Conservation of Southern Bluefin Tuna. Now, we had the scientific meeting of that commission in Cape Town just over a month ago, and now the commission itself is meeting, which is a group of the delegated commissioners, one from each country and their support teams, and they get together to make, usually annually, to make decisions about the management and regulations that apply to the fisheries, and that's what they're meeting about this week in Cape Town.
And as I alluded to right at the beginning, it's about the knock-on effects. It's not just about the fishing numbers, it's about how communities are affected, and especially in a country such as South Africa, where we already have a 38% unemployment rate, a scary youth unemployment rate of around 60%, or very close to it at least. We can't just see this issue as a one-dimensional issue.
You're very right. And in South Africa, to return from the international tuna stage to local, our fisheries are, the states of our fisheries are very different. If we think of the ones that are more deep water, hake, which is our biggest fishery and most important fishery by far, and fisheries like sardine and anchovy, broadly speaking, they're okay. Sardine at the moment has a problem, but hake and anchovy are fine, and that's good news. But where the real problems are, as you alluded to earlier, are with our inshore resources. West Coast rock lobster is a concern. Abalone is a concern. And with both of them, poaching is rife and is the reason why with abalone, there's virtually no legal fishery. Yeah. With West Coast rock lobster, there were court cases about, a court case about this last year. But there again, the legal fishery has to be substantially reduced, primarily because of the impact of poaching. And it's very easy to say, well, more policing stop the poaching. But there is a social... social forces that are that are underlying this as well, and one needs holistic solutions to it. It's very easy to say, these poachers should be stopped, put in more police, but at a certain level, people are just trying to survive, but one mustn't be too kind about this because, to be honest, though certainly there are some people that deserve our sympathy and they're really struggling to make ends meet and they have to turn to illegal activities to keep bread on the table, so to speak. There are also highly organized gangs here.
Yes.
This is an exercise in criminality as well, unfortunately. Mm. With abalone, it became a drugs for abalone exercise as well, and there one can have no sympathy, and really we need tougher enforcement.
You know, I was just I was fortunate enough to do a little bit of work with former Minister Trevor Manuel on the Deep Sea Commission, I think it was. I forget the name of the thing, actually. And one of the things that was mentioned, obviously deep sea is above your actual borders that you can manage as a country, but as part of those discussions, though, it did gravitate towards the communities. And you're so right, because you seem to have a link between triads, Cape Flats gangs, everybody with a great commercial interest in what's happening beneath, you know, the surface, roping in these communities, and some of that money finding its way to buy drugs and a whole host of other things. So it is a lot deeper and needs more attention. But I'd just like to thank you so much, Professor, for making your time available this morning. Professor Doug Butterworth, Emeritus Professor of Applied Mathematics at UCT. And I'm asking you to call into the show this morning and talk to me about what you know about what's happening in our various fishing communities. Maybe you lived there. Maybe you work there. Maybe you're a business person that has dealings with people who come from these fishing communities. Maybe you've got suggestions as to what regional governments can do, because if we're going to fill the gap, it definitely needs to take place from a socioeconomic perspective, creating other opportunities for people who no longer can do what their fathers and their forefathers did, which was make a living from the ocean. So the number to dial, 021-446-0567, and WhatsApp on 072-567-1567. Where are those solutions? So, Professor Doug Butterworth, good luck, and hopefully you enjoy all the proceedings at the CTICC.
Fine. Thanks very much, and thanks for your time and the opportunity to get some of these points across to the public.
The pleasure is all ours. Thank you very much, Professor. Talking to you next, you're listening to Cape Talk, and this is Today. Keno with you all the way through until midday.